Joe Biden personally responsible for this deadly disaster? That's what he should be impeached for. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Steve Hilton Show. By the way, have you checked out my new show, Big Ideas Book Club with Steve Hilton? Absolutely fantastic conversations there. As the name suggests, big ideas that someone's gone to the trouble of writing a book about. I think you'll find these conversations really interesting. Please check out that show. Today, we've got some great conversations about California, about Afghanistan, and the testimony of the generals, which is a massive, massive indictment of Joe Biden's policy there. But I do want to start with the story that was the big one over the last few days and is such a massive example of the worst tendencies of the media in this country. Of course, I'm talking about the bloodbath hoax, which was unfolding before my eyes. I remember seeing it unfold on Sunday morning and I thought, no, they're not really doing this, are they? They're not really going to go with this. It's so stupid. It's so ridiculous. It makes them look so stupid. But no, they have no shame. They have no thought in their head other than Trump must be destroyed. Trump is a maniac. Trump is deranged. They are deranged by Trump, of course. We've known that for years. And so they push this stuff out there. Now, look, any independent-minded person would say, yes, of course, there are things that Donald Trump says, or you could look at the policy agenda while in government and you can make legitimate criticisms. Now, we could disagree about what they are. We could have a reasonable conversation about what he says, what he does, and keep it to the facts and have a reasonable disagreement as people do in politics. But when you have something like this, which is so obviously totally dishonest and fake, right? We know the story. Let's just, remind ourselves of what this was about. This is what Donald Trump said. This is the full statement that they all went completely mad about, the bloodbath. Let's just listen to what he actually said at that rally in Ohio last weekend.
If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico right now, and you think you're going to get that, you're going to not hire Americans, and you're going to sell the cars to us. Now, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
It is so obvious. He was talking about the economy and specifically the car industry, the auto industry. It's obvious. I mean, no one can distort that, right? So what do they try and do? They try and make out that Donald Trump is plotting a literal bloodbath. Like literally people will be, I don't know, injured, killed, there'll be blood on the streets. That's literally what they were trying to make out he was saying. So here's a reminder of the most egregious and ridiculous examples of the condemnation that flowed down, starting with Nancy Pelosi the next morning. Nancy Pelosi on CNN.
He's even predicting a bloodbath. What does that mean? He's going to exact a bloodbath? There's something wrong here.
The idea that they're going to be able to spin their way out of this today is ridiculous, because every single day Donald Trump is promoting and endorsing and encouraging political violence on the stump.
He was talking only about the auto industry, and this is one more. It's just bullshit. Let me say that at 6:15 a.m. It's just bullshit. He knew what he was doing. We're not stupid. Americans aren't stupid. He was talking about a bloodbath. Sometimes a bloodbath means a bloodbath.
I mean, for goodness sake, what are they talking about? They're saying that, oh, because earlier in the speech, he said something that they didn't like about January the 6th or whatever, that later in the speech, when he's using a turn of phrase that they all use the whole time, and by the way, let's remind ourselves of the amount of times that they talk about a bloodbath in all sorts of contexts.
Columnist Charles Blow has a new piece for the New York Times entitled A Biden Bloodbath.
2018 midterms, you can bet that they 100% are fearing a slaughter. In fact, the word bloodbath and massacre come up frequently.
The Republican Party will be destroyed. It's going to be a bloodbath.
There's going to be a bloodbath one way or the other.
Bloodbath for Bernie Sanders.
It's been a bloodbath there, shaping up to be a bloodbath.
Head off a bloodbath in next year's crucial midterm.
Off-year elections are often a bloodbath.
This week's bloodbath for Democrats.
A bloodbath at the ballot box.
So, I mean, you know, what if I now said there needs to be a bloodbath in the media as a result of this absolutely ridiculous, dishonest distortion of what Donald Trump said? Why does there need to be a bloodbath in the media? Because actually, it's not just another example of them lying and completely making fools of their claims to be independent journalists or whatever. This time, it's actually really serious. They're talking about violence. They are the ones who are riling up their base to try and conjure up images of political violence. They're the ones doing it. And yet again, it's an example of them doing the exact thing that they accuse everyone else of. It is so reckless. It is so irresponsible. Of course, it's dishonest, but it's worse than dishonest because they're actively trying to conjure this specter of political violence with Donald Trump when they're the ones that are promoting that. I mean, honestly, I thought I had seen everything, but this bloodbath hoax was just the worst example of the complete disgrace of American journalism, where they've completely abandoned any attempt to be objective, to bring people the truth, and they are clearly now only in one business, which is to stop Donald Trump because they think that he's this mortal threat to democracy, and in the name of that, they themselves are undermining democracy at every turn. So here's the policy story I want to talk about this week. And just pay attention to that word policy, because as I'm taping this, I'm just fresh from watching the testimony of two retired generals. I'm sure you've seen the reporting of all this by now. Milley, McKenzie. They were up on Capitol Hill testifying about the withdrawal from Afghanistan. This testimony is absolutely devastating to Joe Biden especially, but also to Antony Blinken. Why? Because of that word policy. They were asked for their explanation of how we had this catastrophic, shambolic withdrawal from Afghanistan. And remember the consequences of that catastrophe, not just in the short term, the absolute humiliation for America, the shambles, the global spectacle of America humiliated, what that did to our reputation in the short term and the lasting effect of that. Also in the short term, the deaths of those 13 service members at Abbey Gate, totally avoidable deaths as a direct result of this. But beyond that, the consequences of this appalling, I don't want to even call it a mistake, because as we'll hear, and we heard from the generals, it's deliberate. The consequences of this, way beyond even those in the moment, because as I said at the time, this fiasco in Afghanistan was what gave Vladimir Putin the green light to invade Ukraine. So all of the death and destruction and mayhem, the global impact of that invasion, you can trace back to this moment in Afghanistan. And what we heard today from the military, from the generals who are no longer there and bound by their jobs to toe the party line, as it were, was incredibly clear. They said that this was a policy decision. It was not a military decision. The whole thing was decided at the policy level. What does that mean? By the politicians, and specifically Joe Biden. Joe Biden overruled the military to order the immediate withdrawal, including all troops. This was completely contrary, we learned today, to the plan that had been approved by President Trump. So President Trump, as a policy matter, said, we've got to get out of Afghanistan. That was a promise that he made, wanted to end the foreign wars, get out of Afghanistan, well known. So he asked for plans to do that. And the plans were drawn up. And what we heard today was that President Trump selected an option which included the retention of 2,500 troops in Afghanistan, to keep the show on the road, to make sure that the whole place wasn't just overrun by the Taliban. That's what President Trump selected. We learned that today. So all these people at the time of Afghanistan and the fiasco saying, well, this is exactly what Trump would have done. No, we learned today that that is not what Trump would have done. We heard that from the generals. He approved a plan that would have kept 2,500 troops there on Inauguration Day. That's what we learned today. But Biden ripped that up. He said, no, I want everybody out. And that policy decision was against the advice of the commanders on the ground, against the advice of the military. It was the direct policy decision of Joe Biden. and it led to all these disasters. And more than that, even the chaos in the moment was the direct result of these policy decisions, now encompassing not just Joe Biden, but Antony Blinken, because it was very clear from the testimony today that the actual chaos of the evacuation of the embassy and Afghan allies and all of that, that was also the result of policy decisions from the State Department, because it was very clear from the testimony today that the plans for the evacuation of people who were working there, non-military employees and so on, it was led by the State Department. And as early as July, months before the final days of chaos, the military were saying to the State Department, we're getting ready to do this evacuation, but you haven't told us what you want to do. You haven't instructed us to prepare the ground for this evacuation. Nothing's happening. Why don't you let us get on with it? And the State Department dithered and did nothing until the final days. And then it ended in total shambles, deadly shambles, as far as those service members and brave heroes of Abbey Gate are concerned. The State Department, it was a policy decision. Antony Blinken. And so, frankly, as I said at the time, and you can go back and watch the tape on my Fox News show, I said, because it was very clear that this was a policy decision taken by Joe Biden, overruling the advice of everyone around him and the military leaders on the ground, he alone is responsible. He's personally responsible. And he, therefore, has the blood of those soldiers on his hands. It would not have happened without that decision, against the advice of everyone around him. And that's why I said at the time that Joe Biden should be impeached over what happened in Afghanistan. It was a crime. He caused the deaths of those service members at Abbey Gate. Joe Biden caused it. He overruled his military officers. He ignored the advice. He did it anyway because he was so bloody minded. He wanted to get everyone out on a particular timetable, disgracefully on a timeline of September the 11th. That was the date that he picked to try and have this scurrying away, this surrender to the Taliban. Joe Biden's personal responsibility. That's what he should be impeached for. These ridiculous Republicans trying to impeach him, that's all collapsed now, hasn't it? Because they couldn't find anything. They couldn't find a crime. Of course, we know about Joe Biden's corruption, Hunter Biden, all the rest of it. But most of that happened before he was president. This Afghanistan disaster, this happened while he was president. This is something he did as president. Joe Biden, personally responsible for this utter disaster, this deadly disaster. He should be impeached. If he had any shame at all, he would have resigned. So would Antony Blinken. But now we know it's been confirmed. It was the policy decisions of Joe Biden, in particular, Antony Blinken, to a certain extent, that caused the most humiliating foreign policy and military disaster America has suffered for at least 50 years. An absolute fiasco with lasting disastrous effects. Joe Biden responsible for it. He should be impeached for it. All right, come on, stop laughing, Jen. It's Jen Horn. It's California Corner. We've been, you know, having some fun. And now we've turned to the serious issues in California Corner this week. Top of the list is what is going on with the flagship measure Gavin Newsom put on the ballot, insisted all the other things be taken off the ballot that his colleagues in the legislature wanted to put on the ballot because it's got to be Proposition 1. He called it Proposition 1, so it would be number one and the top priority, and it was going to be his legacy. It was going to solve homelessness for good and mental health. It's going to be amazing, and his calling card for the great success of his governorship, and he spent millions and millions of dollars, and nobody had any money on the other side, and yet here we are. It's like on a knife edge, and it's 2 weeks, literally 2 weeks after the election we're taping this. We still don't even know if it's passed.
It's stunning to me that we count votes for as long as we do. They're not certifying the results of the election till the middle of April. So there is still a lot of time that can mess with races like this. When the last time I checked, which was literally 24 hours ago. So I checked on a Monday, which was March 18th. And they were 20,000 votes apart from the yeses and Amazing. Nos. And think about the money that was sunk into the yes on Proposition 1. There was not a lot of, there wasn't any money put into no on Prop 1. It was really the conservative media and activist groups who spread the word about why this isn't a great idea for California. And it actually worked and people voted no. And I think a lot of healthcare professionals probably voted no on this. And so it is amusing to sit back and watch Gavin Newsom, who had a smiling Joker face on every single one of those yes on Prop No ads, now saying, oh, we got to spend more money to try to cure votes, because he's now looking at the ballots that were rejected. And this is such a close margin that he's now spending money, and he's getting money from the health insurance companies as well. Blue Cross just spent $125,000 to give him money to grab the ballots that either had a problem with the signature or a problem with one of the bubbles, to grab those ballots and to try to get Democrats to fix them and send them back in so they can be counted. Well, now the no people who had conceded right after Election Day, really just a week after Election Day, they're saying, wait a second, we're only 20,000 votes apart. We could cure our ballots, because there's a very good chance that Republican ballots and no party preference ballots in the state of California are going to have no votes on them. So now they're in the fight once again, and I'm glad to see it. And this thing is still very much on. And it's just amazing. Fun to watch Gavin Newsom have to struggle through this when a lot of his political collateral was put into Prop 1. And how do you explain that to the Democrat Party when you want to be president?
It's amazing. Can we just talk about this curing ballots thing? I mean, what is going on with our elections? I mean, what does it mean, curing ballots? So what is it? It's so ridiculous.
They're not sick, but it might mean that if you did a by-mail ballot and maybe you forgot to sign it, or if maybe your signature doesn't match whatever signature they have in the system, or if maybe you didn't bubble something, if there's a problem with that, they might throw your ballot aside.
So would you know, even putting aside the Prop 1 thing, right? If that's the case, if you voted and you thought you were voting and your vote was counted, but it was rejected for one of these reasons, right? You forgot to sign it, your signature didn't match, you didn't do the bubble correctly, whatever.
Right.
Would you know about that?
This is what I tell people that listen to my show. I love to vote in person. It just makes me feel good. But this year, the Republican Party asked us to vote early so that they could bank our vote. So for the first time, I was like, all right, let's try the by-mail process. And I kind of went through the process. The only good thing is that if you go to the Secretary of State website, you can track your ballot through the process,
yes,
and it will tell you when it's been counted. So that's sos.ca.gov, and you can go through. They have a ballot tracks program, and then you can track your ballot. For people who don't do that, it's very possible that you think you voted, and unless somebody contacts you and tells you otherwise, you may not ever know that your vote wasn't counted. And that's what's so dangerous, because depending on who they think you're going to vote for, they may not be interested in reaching out and telling you that your vote wasn't counted. The first time I even heard about this, and I thought it was bananas, was when there was the race with, it was Katie Hill, and it was, you know, Mike Garcia came on into that race. That district, they were trying to find ballots to cure because it was so close. It was Mike Garcia the first time won 333 votes. And so they were in the process of curing ballots in that race. And that's the first time I had even heard of it. It's something that only happens with the by-mail system. And it is really silly, because once again, if it wouldn't bother me so much if they try to attempt to track down everybody to cure their ballot. But what happens is that whoever has the most money can spend the most resources tracking those ballots. So for instance, Newsom and his war chest has a lot of money to go to bat and find people he thinks voted yes on Prop 1.
Why does it cost money? Why should it be a
probably
question of
the
money?
Outreach? I would imagine the staff to call people, the staff to maybe go door to door and say, "Hey, your ballot was there was something wrong with it."
So this is another example where money it means you can win, because if one side does this curing to people, like they can match it with voter registration, right? So they can say, well, which of the, let's say there's 1,000, or use that round number. There's 1,000. You know, problematic ballots in this county, they can see which of the, they can see which of those people is a registered Democrat
and
go back
go after
to only
those.
Them and ignore the rest. This
exactly
is so
right.
outrageous. Look, it's just outrageous. Like everyone should be. I mean, I'm getting very angry about it. It's another example of the complete sort of banana republic ridiculousness of our system. This should be the rule, which is, sorry, you messed up, your ballot didn't count, get it right next time. Or everyone should have the opportunity to be cured on an equal basis, regardless of party, partisanship, or money.
Exactly right. And this is where I think people get so, first of all, I think most people don't even know about this, number one. Number two, the people that do are probably going, this does not sound right. This feels wrong. It's what people hate about politics, where it's not about how you vote or what's right or what's wrong, or even educating voters at this point. It's now about who has the most resources to get a campaign infrastructure built so that they can go out and get the people. And that's what makes people sick about politics, because it becomes less about the candidate or the proposition and more about who's got the money to spend.
I mean, it's very interesting. I'm glad you brought this up, Jen. I mean, obviously, it's interesting that they're so desperate for every last vote for this Proposition 1 that they're going back and going through this process. But it's revealed another massive problem with our whole system.
And we should be calling this stuff out. You know, one of the things I talk about Assemblyman Bill Asaley a lot, but one of the ideas that he had when he first came into the state legislature is to make one day for Election Day, make it a holiday if you have to. I hate the idea because I think people should make the time to go vote, but go out there, make it a holiday, forget this by mail stuff. It just creates more and more problems, distrust in the system. And when people lose faith, that's when we start to lose everything. And it is also interesting to note just how close this is that Gavin Newsom had to cancel his State of the State address, which was supposed to be this last Monday.
The celebration.
Because not only does he not have anything to celebrate with Prop 1 yet, but he's also got this budget mess. And so it is someone who right now wants to be riding the waves to the presidency is now having to do a little paddling to stay afloat. And at least I guess that's the silver lining for those of us who are maybe not the biggest fans of Newsom.
Okay, so let's move on. let's move on to the second topic, which is, you know, I'm sure connected to the budget issue, because despite our absolute, you know, catastrophe of a budget, totally avoidable, we had a surplus. They threw it away with, well, they not threw it away. They spent it on trying to bribe voters with these inflation relief payments, or whatever they called it a couple of years ago. Now, more money for the high speed. I thought that had gone away.
You know, this is one of those stories that, again, I think if you went out on the street and said, do you know California's still building that bullet train? Most people would say, no, I thought that was over. I thought that was done. It's been going on since what, like 2008? And if you remember, it was, and I actually had to go back and jog my memory because I remember that Dianne Feinstein's husband, Richard Bloom, had actually gotten the first contract for that first link that was like Madeira to Fresno. This is where the swamp is way alive in California.
Wait, what did he do? I thought he was a lawyer, or was he doing the legal work?
He was part of this development firm, I believe, the contract. So they made $1 billion off the first link of track. Mm-hmm. And the amount of money that they spent per mile in that deal, Steve, was $35 million per mile in that first initial build. And then they would build like pieces here and there. And so if you remember, when President Trump got into office, he went to California and he said, guys, you have messed up this project, so we're taking back our federal money.
Yes.
And Gavin Newsom went crazy. Gavin Newsom's like, you can't take the federal money. We're not gonna pay you back. And then Gavin Newsom says, fine, we're just gonna end the project. So that's where I think most people are. Like, it stopped and we thought, this is just, it's gone. Well, no, there's still a high-speed rail authority in California, and they just asked, are you ready? You're sitting down for this one? You are. $135 billion to finish the project. Do you know how much money we've already dumped in? And now they want $135 billion
more. The original budget was $30 billion.
Of
the whole thing was $30 billion back then, and it was supposed to be open by now.
By now. And what I had totally forgotten, and God love my production staff on The Morning Answer, because the one thing I'm really for is the high speed rail between LA and Las Vegas, because I think people will actually use it. It will actually be high speed because of the technology. And I think they'll actually be able to do something with that project. The one that they're building now, holy smokes. And so my producer came running in this morning and said, don't forget, Jen, it's not even really a high speed train from LA to San Francisco. It only goes like 80 miles per hour. So you're expecting people to pay a lot of money to recoup the hundreds of billions of dollars you spent trying to build this thing. And it's probably just as quick to get in your car and drive up the 5 freeway from Los Angeles to San Francisco.
I didn't know that. I mean, look, I'm not surprised because I remember we had this in England. And we were all in favor of high-speed rail, the government that I worked for. And in England is much, much smaller. And we've got a history of railways, and it's, you know, it's part of the culture in a way it just isn't in America. certainly in California. Anyway, so we said, let's do high-speed rail. And high-speed rail, you go to France and Spain, fantastic. You know, it really mm-hmm. worked. We just did the high-speed rail from Madrid to Barcelona.
Right.
It was like 300 and I was watching. They have the speed in the car. It's amazing. It was like 310. Was it my car? I mean, miles.
It actually moves, right?
It's incredible. It was a beautiful experience. Lovely modern train. Great. They give you food. It's like being on an airplane. Amazing.
Yeah.
and not expensive. It was just amazing. And everyone uses it. So it makes money because everyone uses it and it's mm-hmm. all good. So this one, we had that in England. And I remember, and I was really for it. Until someone, I actually said, okay, how's it going to work? And we sat down, and the first leg of it that they were talking about was London to Birmingham. And I don't know, I'll get all the numbers wrong here. I don't know, 120 miles, something like that, quite short distance. And I wanted to get a briefing on it. And they said, well, of course, it's not really high-speed rail for most of it. I said, what do you mean? Well, you know, to make it high-speed, it has to be straight.
Mm-hmm.
You can only go really fast if it's straight. And of course, as you're leaving London, you're going through the central
the
London
dealings,
and then the suburbs and the people live there and whatever. So it's, you know, you're going around corners and so it's not very fast. And then, you know, you're getting into Birmingham and it's the same kind of deal and you have to slow down because, which all makes sense, except A, that's not how it happens in Europe because they built it properly so that you go pretty straight almost all the way to the city center. But then I said, well, so how much of this is actually high speed? I said, well, you know, about 30 miles just in the middle.
They're like, wait a second.
So it's not high speed. So I said, how much faster is it going to be than the current train that we have that actually people use all the time and is perfectly? Well, you know, maybe it'll take 10, 15 minutes off the time. So why are we spending all this money?
All this money.
Like,
see,
for something that's
going to
barely be better than what we have now.
And I think, you know, look, I know that people think if you are a conservative, you can't be for mass transit. I actually, as someone who's born and raised in LA, I would love to have mass transit that would alleviate the traffic snarls
yes.
that are all over Southern California, right? I'm all for it. But my goodness, make it count for people. And how about for let's get away from these contracts. Like, let people actually bid on projects. Let's reach out beyond our inner circle of people. Let's get projects done that are really going to be helpful instead of just dumping money in a hole. Because what I feel like this high-speed train is that you're basically paying back all these people who support these politicians who get elected, and you're dumping money for a train and you're literally throwing it into just an empty train hole and we're never going to get that back. No one's ever going to see anything. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. But yeah, there is still the train. It's still being built, but now they need a lot more money to get it done.
From where? We have a deficit.
Right.
What are they talking about? It's all
I don't know where they're going to get it.
Okay. What about, I was in Orange County last week.
Mm-hmm.
And in San Diego, people were telling me about Todd Spitzer, the DA, Orange County DA, and these billboards. I'd heard about that. And you were wanting to talk about this as well. What's the story here?
Well, when I heard about this, I immediately get Todd on the phone, and he's fantastic. He's like, they should call him Todd Spitfire instead of Spitzer, because he is just, he doesn't take anything lying down. And he's very quick to point out that the DAs in Riverside County, Mike Kestrin, Jason Anderson, and San Bernardino, and then he, of course, is the DA of Orange County, are suffering because George Gascon in Los Angeles doesn't prosecute any crime. So what are they seeing? Since everything is so connected, they're seeing a huge uptick in smash and grab robberies, in residential burglaries, all of these things in Orange County, Riverside, and San Bernardino, because George Gascon has spread the message that you can do this stuff and you're not going to get into trouble. Mm-hmm. So this stat was amazing. Of the 141 smash and grabs in Orange County in like the last few months, mm-hmm. 140 of the criminals they caught, in 141 of these were from LA County.
That is amazing.
Is that stunning? They're not Orange County people who are doing this. They're LA County people. So he thought, what am I going to do? Well, he had some money that was not based on taxpayer funds. He actually took the money that he had when criminals leave stuff behind. Mm-hmm. They leave whatever goods and services that no one ever recovers. They sell those things and they have like a slush fund that's supposed to be like anti-crime, essentially, that they mm-hmm. can put towards whatever anti-crime initiatives. So they put that money, the criminals' money, into this campaign, which I think is brilliant.
Yeah.
And they put up billboards and they've done bus ads and they've done all these things that say, don't commit crime in Orange County. We prosecute where LA doesn't.
And these ads are in LA.
They are. They're in L.A. They're in Orange County. They're all over Southern California. And there's one right at the border, the 5 freeway, as you transition from L.A. into Orange County. And Todd Spitzer said, of course, within a few hours of this thing being resurrected, some person climbed up and graffitied it and said that Orange County does doesn't prosecute crime. Like, they crossed it out. And so he said, you know, I was going to leave. He said, I didn't know what to do. The billboard company said they wanted to get up there. They have a policy to go up there and fix these things when they get defaced. And he said, you know what? I told them not to do it. And they thought I was crazy. But he said, I think that graffiti makes a point about how terrible LA is being run. And so he left it up there in that way. And amazing. Here we are. Good for Todd Spitzer, but it must be hard to try to deal with George Gascon's Los Angeles and the incentives that are being given to criminals around here.
It's brilliant. I love it. That it's so clever. And I've always been a big fan, you know, when I think about policy, of making sure that you communicate about policy in order to make sure people understand it. Because so often politicians, you know, they make some change or they pass a law, whatever, but it doesn't actually change behavior because people aren't aware of it. And so it's a really, really, people can dismiss it as a gimmick, but it really isn't. It's actually a very, very clever thing to do, and everyone's talking about it, and it's great.
I think it's great too, and we need more of this. It may just be billboards and people say it's not really changing things, but you know what it does? It makes people who are going to vote for George Gascon again maybe look up and say there's a different way, and I think it's extremely important.
Let's just have a quick check-in on that, because I haven't seen you since we got the results. So you were very much for Jonathan Hatami.
I was for Hatami
in the DA race. And it didn't go to him. Nathan Hochman is going to be facing up against Gascon in the fall. I mean, I like Nathan Hochman. I think he's very good. He's impressive. I mean, he's certainly better than George Gascon.
Look, Nathan Hochman has 1,000% of my support right now. There were a whole field of people that I really liked and that I liked a whole lot better than George Gascon, every single one of them. So to have at least a choice, I think, is really important. It shocks me that 20% of Los Angeles voted for George Gascon in this primary. But what's good about Nathan Hochman is he's very well funded, which is important because we know that the money is going to come in from the socialist wing of the Democrat Party into Gascon's campaign. So the funding really matters. They're already, the only thing that worried me about Hochman is that they're already saying, well, he's a Republican. He's got that Republican stink on him and that he only changed recently to become an independent. So I think that he's very well trained in how to answer that because I've heard him answer why he is no longer a Republican. And I hope that just doesn't deter voters in LA County who think that the R word is a bad word. Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful. And I think that if you coalesce, and I would call on every single candidate, including Hatami and John McKinney and Judge Deborah Archuleta, all of the people who came in towards the top of that list, they need to be out there and they need to be helping Nathan Hochman. Put the bad blood aside, put all of that behind them. Because if we can coalesce all the votes that didn't vote for Gascon behind Hochman, I think we'll be in a good position.
Yeah, I agree. I was just emailing with him. I think we're going to have him on the show next week. So that's something to look forward to. I think he's very well qualified and absolutely 1,000%. I mean, we've got to get rid of Gascon. Everyone should be part of that effort. Jen, great to see you.
You can,
of course, hear Jen every morning on the Morning Answer AM 870. I'll be with you on Friday morning.
Can't wait.
Until next time. Thank you, Jen.
Thanks.
Joining us for Candidate Corner today, absolutely fantastic. I'm so pleased she's with us. I've met her a couple of times now in the Central Valley where I've spent very happy times. I love that part of our state. And I love this candidate, Ali Macedo. How are you doing? Great to see you today.
We share that. I love the Central Valley as well. And it is an honor to be here, Steve. Good to see you again.
So tell everyone a little bit of background. What's the district you're running? What's the position you're running for, the district, and then a little bit about yourself?
Okay, so I am running in Assembly District 33, which is in Central California. It includes all of Kings County, most of Tulare County, and a small portion of Fresno County. We're a very heavy ag district, and I'm running for that Assembly seat. A little bit of background on me. I was born and raised here in Tulare, California, and my family's deeply rooted in ag. I kind of jokingly tell people I've got dirt in my veins because it's kind of been my life from the beginning. We own the oldest livestock market in the state of California. It started in 1939 by my great-grandfather and a fourth generation involved with that and the first female. We also farm almonds. that my grandfather started with a $400 bank loan. We're carrying on that legacy. My mom is a civil engineer, and so I actually partnered with her when I moved home from school, and we focused in ag design, permitting, and compliance. And I very quickly realized that we needed legal minds in ag because I kept going head to head with these administrative agencies that just like to make our life a lot more difficult. And so after law school, I stayed working, but I was able to graduate debt-free with an established client base, and I started my own business, which is Macedo Environmental Consulting, and that's what I'm doing now. And I have fought tooth and nail for ag down here on the regional level, just really trying to slow down some bad regulation that's hindering us from doing what we do. Mm-hmm. And realized very quickly, I need to take my fight to Sacramento. There's bad legislation that's coming out of SAC, and it's giving power to these administrative agencies to create bad regulation. And there's a lot of people that don't know the difference between legislation and regulation. But what I will say is for regulation, there's a lot less oversight and there's a lot less accountability. And I aim to change that.
Who represents this district now? What's the sort of dynamics of your race?
So Devin Mathis has this seat right now. He's had it. When he finishes his term, it'll be 10 years, and he has so graciously endorsed our campaign, so very grateful for that.
So he's a Republican, and he's there now, but he's termed out, as it were. Is that right?
He actually could have done one more term, but he's decided to seek other opportunities, and now hopefully mm-hmm. we're going to take that spot.
And what happened in the primary?
I'm so proud to talk about this, because we did no polling going into the primary. Kind of didn't know where the voters were going to end up. This was my first election. But our voter dynamic is 35% Republican, 35% Democrat, and then the rest are independent, declined to state, with the understanding that the independent, declined to state is typically more of a conservative group. But I didn't really know how it was going to turn out, and it turned out really well for us. We won more than 20 points over the second place person, and almost beat him 2-1. He's also a fellow Republican. So really grateful we're going to keep this seat red. And there was 5 people on my ticket. So we knocked out 3 Democrats in the top 2, ended up being Republican. So very exciting.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, congratulations. So before we get, I want to spend a little time on the ag industry and farmers and the issues there. But your district is so big. I mean, just how do you because it goes right up to the, I mean, how far exactly does it stretch geographically?
So I go out to like Avenel and Kettleman is far out there. And then I go all the way up into like Reedley and Dinuba, that I don't get to complain as much as somebody like David that we talked about earlier. His is huge. But I will tell you, I drive a diesel pickup truck. And so driving around, because I have been all over this dang district, and it's such a beautiful district, lots of ag, but it is huge and it's tough. I work full time as well. So definitely put some miles on my car, my Keurig, and my cell phone. They've all worked overtime in this election, let me tell you. But yeah, we have a pretty expansive district, 500,000 people in the district.
So look, the overwhelming sense I get, the more time I spend in Fresno and with farmers, is that there's just this absolute disconnect between the fact that we have this incredible industry where we are world leaders, where we feed not just our own state, but the whole country and the whole world. And in so many of these industries, you meet farmers in California and they're part of an industry that is, you know, what is it, 80% of the world's almonds, 70% of the world's pistachios, berry, you know, on and on you go. And actually, it's not just in the Central Valley. It's also places like in the Salinas Valley. You know, there's just all around the state, down in Imperial County, where I was a couple of months ago. Incredible strength of our agricultural sector. And yet, the Democrats, who have this one-party control of state government and a lot of local government, county and local government, seem to like wish it would just go away. You know, they're actively hostile to our farming industry.
It's really devastating. California has the most bountiful soil, the most temperate climate, and all of the technology in the world that we absolutely could be a superpower that no other country would want a war with us. No other country would want a bad relationship with us because we have the ability to feed ourselves, which is an absolute necessity for life. The unfortunate truth is you're 100% right. There is a mass exodus of agriculture, especially generational agriculture, from the state of California, because the future of ag is so questionable. So lots of people are telling their kids, you know, I don't know what's going to be here for you in the next 5 years. And they're cashing out and going to other states, or they're going into different industries that aren't as labor intensive, aren't as regulation intensive, because they're spending dollars to make pennies. And there's tons of risk involved in what we do. In agriculture, we're 100% dependent on everything else, on the market, on the weather, on labor, on the availability of resources, and we are continuously having to produce more with less. The problem is, in the state of California, is ag's been so good at it that legislators, but Democrats particularly, have continued to impose more and more regulation and more fees and more hurdles for ag to jump over, because they've done it, and they've done it extraordinarily well. But we're reaching a point now that we can only be pushed to the brink of breaking before we're crying uncle and we're moving on to, you know, to something else. People don't know what it's like to not to, you know, to go to the grocery store and not see food on the shelves. And that's a very real thing in other countries, that they don't have the ability to produce their own food. And the fact is, it's terrifying to me when I go to the grocery store to buy produce, and I'm buying produce from foreign countries rather than produce that's grown, you know, right up the road from me. And, you know, less than 1% of the produce that's imported into the United States is inspected, but 99% of the food that's grown here in the United States is inspected and regulated. So why are we providing a safe food source for other countries, but we're not worried about a secure food source for our own people? It just doesn't make sense.
So let's go through some of the issues that are most prominent concerns. The ones I hear all the time, there's certainly water, and then labor regulation. What are the other ones?
In general, just water is top of the priority for most farmers, because SGMA is aiming to fallow a million.
What is SGMA?
It's a Sustainable Groundwater Management Act that our aquifers are depleted. We're having issues with the safety and sustainability of our water. And so, you know, we're looking closely at water usage and imposing very strict rules on how much water our farmers can use. And so pretty severe fines if, you know, you don't. And then lots of fines for using the water, which in ag, we're not saying is a bad thing. We are just saying that the way that it's being implemented is absolutely going to cripple California agriculture. It will fallow a million acres of farm ground. We will lose 80,000 jobs associated with those million acres. We're going to lose probably billions of dollars in commerce, all for the simple fact of we're going to fallow parcel X so we can make sure we have enough water for parcel Y. But rather than using what we have, which is funding for water projects for storage and transportability and sustainability and all of those things, we're kind of continuing to perpetuate the problem. And that's where I disagree a lot with SGMA, because if we could compensate for the 2.5 million acre foot shortage that we have here in the Central Valley, which we can if we had proper water storage and transport channels, we could keep all of that farm ground in operation, properly irrigated, replenish our underground water supply, and make sure that not just agriculture has water, but our population has water. And that's something that people don't always make that connection. But in rural areas like mine, we're dependent on groundwater for drinking water sometimes as well. So SGMA is going to absolutely change the face of agriculture. We're fighting. We have GSAs that are fighting, water districts that are fighting. And so we're really, really going to need to bring our resources together to make sure that we're all on the same page when it comes to that. Now, all the problems that come after that are problems, and we'll discuss them. But if we don't have water, we don't have crops. We can't do what we do without water. So that's top of my priority list.
So this is a deliberate act from the state, which will result in a million acres being taken out of an industry that's really successful. It's just absolutely insane. Imagine if the government of California said, right, let's take another industry where we're world leaders, technology. We're going to shut down, you know, half of Google's data centers or whatever because they use too much energy. You know, it's crazy.
Here's the difference, Steve, and I love that you made this parallel. With agriculture, we have perishable products. So we don't have shelf life to figure things out like somebody like technology does, and they can have laptops sitting in a warehouse somewhere. And once agricultural land is taken out of production, it's not put back into production. So, you know, I will say that we're getting creative as far as things like solar projects and, you know, planting crops that maybe we don't need to irrigate and things like that. But no, it's crazy to me that an industry that is leading in California commerce and one of the top providers of jobs. And really, for me, if we don't have agriculture, Tulare, Kings, Fresno and Kern County don't exist.
Yeah, it's sabotage. Deliberate sabotage of one of our great industries. I mean, it's just so offensive to me. Last question on that before we move on to labor. So does this emanate, so it's a law passed by the legislature, or is it the way it's been implemented by the bureaucracy, which is the relevant bureaucracy? Who do we need to fight to turn this around?
You know, a lot of this is a joint effort of legislators and administrative agencies that are leading the way and creating this kind of demon child of an act, right? It's very similar to the phasing out of gas-powered and diesel-powered vehicles and heading towards the EV side. It's very similar for us that they're putting all of these deadlines and these big threatening words on a document that, I'll be honest with you, I would say if you talk to the average farmer, very few of them really understand what SGMA is because mm-hmm. it's this very mm-hmm. enigmatic word, acronym, I guess, that we all just kind of know, okay, it's going to cost us a lot of money and I'm going to have to, you know, report my water usage. But what does that really mean as far as my planning, my cropping going mm-hmm. forward? That's where I'm working with my clients, working on budgeting.
Let's talk about labor. What are the issues there?
So once again, just like I mentioned with the technology analogy, ag is a different beast when it comes to labor because we are a 24/7, 365 industry. Cows have to eat, crops have to be taken care of. And so when it comes to labor, you know, a typical 8-hour workday might not necessarily be achievable. And for a lot of these farm laborers, they don't like the 8-hour workday because they like the ability to get their payment for overtime and things like that. But there's been legislation that it completely made that illegal. And it actually ended up hurting laborers that they were aiming to protect. So what's happening is we don't have enough laborers for what we do. And so we have gone to the mechanization of agriculture to an extreme, which is great for, you know, the people that own the farms if they can afford to do it. But the little guy can't necessarily afford the latest and greatest when it comes to technology. And he's very dependent on his labor mm-hmm. force to make sure that happens. But there is a shortage of labor. And just in general, the rules and regs that are surrounding labor for agriculture, they're really not beneficial. And we've tried to explain that in a way that legislators would understand. But my goal, if I get elected, is actually to bring legislators down to the Central Valley and have them see, first of all, just how much we appreciate our workforce because we need them. But also the things that are actually going to help not only agriculture, but help the laborers, that especially the Democratic Party aims to use as a poster child for who they're trying to protect. And so we're trying to show, look, this is something we all need. There is very easy and achievable solutions, but we've got to cut all this red tape nonsense that's just perpetuating more and more problems, which is labor shortages and the rising cost of doing business in our industry.
I mean, it's just this, it's just another example. They don't know. They don't seem to care. They impose these policies that are just completely inappropriate. They're one size fits all. They make no sense for this particular industry that they clearly disdain.
Yes.
Well, anyway, thank goodness there is a real champion about to enter the legislature, we hope, after the elections are all done with this year. Ali, great to see you today. Can you just remind everyone where they can follow you and support your campaign and so on?
Absolutely. So our website, if you want to hear more about, you know, my thought processes of more than just agriculture, is www.alexandramacedo.com. That's Macedo. You can also follow me on socials, which is Macedo for Assembly, not the number, the actual word. And would love to connect with as many people as possible. And although I am definitely the ag candidate, I have a lot to offer, I believe, the state of California, and that's hope. And you and I have talked about that, Steve. There's so much hope in the state of California, and there's simple solutions. Yes. We just need champions to come in who aren't afraid to get their boots dirty and make change happen.
Fantastic. We love it. Great to see you. Good luck on the trail. And we'll check in with you again before the election. Thank you, Ali.
Absolutely, Steve. You have a great day.
So this is what I want to get off my chest this week. No surprises if you've been following the news. It was the four-year anniversary of the pandemic and the papers going on about that, the media talking about the 4 years since this disaster swept the world, and as if it was some natural disaster that no one could have predicted, no one could have done anything about. And then on top of that, you had all these reports about what we learned from the pandemic, what we learned and what we can reflect on. Absolutely infuriating for two reasons. First of all this reporting around the four-year anniversary totally failed to point out that this whole thing was the direct result of the reckless experiments funded by Fauci. You can go to my initial reporting and all of that, which laid out in great detail how the research, not just funded by Fauci, as everyone says, but commissioned by Anthony Fauci, the leading proponent, the leading global proponent of gain-of-function research. He commissioned this research despite the policies that were in place through the Trump administration and previously the Obama administration to stop this kind of research and put checks on it. He went around it because he's so pig-headed and so arrogant, and he believed in the benefits of this research. It led to a global pandemic, not just the death and destruction in those pandemic years, which of course we all know about. Remember this part of it, that all the costs that we're now having to bear, this is going to go on for, we'll be paying for this for decades. The trillions and trillions of dollars that were spent to bail out businesses and keep things going during the lockdowns and all the rest of it, that is a cost that we'll be bearing for decades to come. And the lockdowns themselves, totally avoidable disaster. You got the pandemic in the first place, an avoidable disaster, because the virus should never have been created in that lab in Wuhan. And then the lockdowns, another avoidable disaster. We should never have had the lockdowns. Totally against the science, totally against the data and the evidence, all the stuff that they told us to follow. Every single thing about it, the 6 feet social distancing, that was total BS, totally unnecessary. It was an airborne virus that could travel much further than 6 feet. The 6 feet rule, just to remind ourselves, was for a completely different disease, something that was spread through droplets that have a sort of weight and fall within a 6 feet distance. And that was just completely wrong for this particular virus that was mainly airborne through these tiny aerosols that travel way further than 6 feet. The whole thing was ridiculous. Most people weren't at risk. Kids were not at risk. Schools should never have been closed. And then finally, now, the other thing that absolutely infuriated me, you saw a report in the New York Times from some of their education and family reporters looking back at the school closures and saying, oh, we should never have closed schools, really. It did incalculable harm to kids' prospects and didn't really do any good in terms of stopping transmission. Well, yes, we said it at the time. I mean, all this stuff that is just coming out now, so, oh, it's, you know, actually looking back on it, we should never have done it. It's not like we've learned things subsequently that tell us this information. We knew it at the time. We knew the essential facts about this disease and how it was transmitted at the time. And some of us said so at the time in March 2020, right? Weeks into this thing, I said that the lockdowns are outrageous. The school closures are outrageous. None of it's justified. I was the first person to put on TV people like Jay Bhattacharya, Scott Atlas, people who were the original scientists and doctors speaking out against the lockdowns. I said so from the beginning. And now for these people to turn around 4 years on and say, oh, well, actually, maybe we shouldn't have done that. It is so effing infuriating. All of this death and destruction and cost that we're going to be bearing for decades could and should have been avoided. All right, that's our show for today. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please make sure you tell all your friends about The Steve Hilton Show and also the Big Ideas Book Club with Steve Hilton, Apple, Spotify, YouTube, and wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you for the next episode very soon.